I'm Luke Gerges.
And I'm Poppy Reed.
And today we speak to the CEO of Rolling Stone, Gus Wenner. Gus is the son of Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner, and he took over Rolling Stone as president in 2017, where he was instrumental in the sale of Rolling Stone to PMC, the company that also owns titles like Variety, Billboard, and The Hollywood Reporter. Rolling Stone is the most iconic music and cultural media brand in the world, but media publications have experienced extreme headwinds over the last 5 years. Vice has shut down its .com, BuzzFeed's market cap is smaller than many seed-stage startups. Both of these companies were once valued at over $1 billion. However, since Gus took over Rolling Stone has grown as a business by almost every measure you can consider, completely bucking the industry trend. Revenue, EBIT, audience size, all up across the board every year since 2018. In a world where cultural media is struggling, Gus has led Rolling Stone to dominate the cultural and music space more than ever before. Gus, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we're here at South By in Austin. Tell us about what Rolling Stone's doing here.
We are doing year two of our Future of Music Showcase, which is a tentpole where we have an issue and a bunch of content where we profile the musicians and acts and artists that we think will define the music of tomorrow. And we connect it to this showcase at the Moody Theater, which is an amazing venue. And it's four nights, and every night is a lineup that's curated by our music team and our event staff. And our goal is to make it feel like you are walking into the pages of that issue. And we launched it last year. It was very successful. This year, we've kind of taken it to a new level, and it's really exciting.
Lines all around the corner from the afternoon.
We had a line yesterday that was seven city blocks long. I asked the head of security at the venue if they'd ever had a longer line for that venue. It's a very famous venue. And he said only for Harry Styles. Last night we had Peso Pluma and Young Miko, and the night before Tizo Touchdown and Faye Webster. And it's just honestly, I think the most exciting thing that happens in the music portion of South by Southwest now, which is awesome. And the sort of spirit of South by and the spirit of Austin is music discovery and, you know, breaking bands and like wandering in somewhere and seeing something really cool that you had no clue about. So it's kind of the perfect alignment for us and what we do with Future Music, and really connecting it to the issue. Like we have Peso on our cover, and we released it sort of as he was walking on stage, and we had digital covers with the other headliners, and again, as they walked on stage, their covers were behind them, and it's just a very cool kind of connected experience, and very much the model that we've taken for our big kind of tentpole moments and tentpole issues, you know, bringing them to life in person and telling really compelling stories and doing compelling journalism and marrying that with like a real life version of it.
It's pretty incredible to experience. Obviously, Luke and I were lucky enough to go along this year, but we first experienced it first year last year as well. And it's one of the reasons why we wanted to bring that to Australia. And I know that Future Music is now a global format. You got all the countries involved. It's pretty great. We're being involved ourselves. But yeah, we want to do similar things to that in Australia at South By because of what you've done here.
That's very exciting. I mean, once you kind of get a format right, there's so much you can do with it. And one of the things that was important to me with this Future Music was making it global amongst our international editions. And you guys have been great, but everyone all across the world coming together around this idea is super exciting. And I think long term, you know, maybe it's something we bring on the road. Maybe it's something we turn into a proper festival. Maybe it's something we produce kind of a docu-series around. There's so much content that comes out of it, which is great. But, you know, do we do little mini films that we distribute on a Netflix or a network, something like that, on these bands and leading up to the show? And I think there's so many... there's so many directions to take it, but the key is really, really good curation. There's, you know, people kind of find music generally right now through kind of algorithms, I think, like what pops up in your YouTube or your Pandora or Spotify. So to have a brand like Rolling Stone that you trust and know kind of has its finger on the pulse, and there's like a really engaged, curious group of people with great taste behind it curating the bill, and then you're not just watching the show, and kind of then you have like a big deep profile, an interview to read, and a photo, iconic photo to look at, and it's just like more of an experience. That's the goal, and I think the music kind of needs that given how dominant the platforms and streaming services have become.
So true. That nuance and that context can only be given by platforms like Rolling Stone. I believe that. I think that your view of media is especially unique given the family that you were born into. And I'm so interested to know what it was like growing up in a family where your dad was arguably the most recognized man in music media. Like, what was that like?
What was it like? Like, what was my childhood like?
What was about your childhood?
No,
you don't need to trauma dump on us.
Yeah,
but just,
I mean, what do you want?
What was the world like? You know, like your daily experience would be so different to most other families.
No, what I would say is that it was very clear to me from a very young age that everything my parents did was for their love of music and art and belief in progressive ideas and what our politics and politicians should represent for people, and freedom of speech and expression, and you can marry who you want and smoke weed and not have to go to jail, and just build kind of a better world. Like that was super clear to me, more so than anything else that came along with it. And so that was a great environment to grow up in.
When you say anything else that came along with it, are you thinking of the kind of access that you would get to music and the people who make it?
Yeah, I mean, access, the success that both of them had. Yeah.
Is there a moment that you look back on when you were a kid, which is like the most, okay, my life is a bit different to most kids?
I think you just have to have perspective on the world. I mean, I felt very fortunate to grow up the way I did and be around the people that I was able to be around, but I wouldn't boil it down to a single moment. But I think having kind of perspective that everyone grows up with different opportunities and different obstacles, and being really conscious of that, not as like a perfunctory thing, but as a part of the reality of the world we live in. So I wouldn't boil it down to one thing. I would just say, like, over time, as I was exposed to more of the world and growing up in New York, where it's such a melting pot, you know, you just get perspective on how I got perspective on how kind of fortunate I was and am. Mm.
And I guess there's experiences like you start a band and it's not just with anyone. It's with the kid Demi Moore's daughter, right? Scout?
Is yes. That right?
Yeah. Yeah. How cool. Like, your world is just different.
Yeah.
I also think it's so interesting what you've done with the Rolling Stone business. And I think that comes from your unique perspective as well. Like, where you've expanded digitally, events are such a huge driver for you, and you've done that on a global level. So I'm interested in where you see print now in 2024.
For us, print is still very important. It's a completely different business than it was. I mean, for up until like 10 years ago, Rolling Stone was a magazine primarily, and print was like, I don't know, probably 80% of our revenues, and was a thriving medium. That has changed completely. It's a much, much smaller business. And very early on, we took some risks with the magazine to build a kind of build it for what it was. And not to get like too technical, but there was a time where, you know, a magazine had a 2 or 3 million subscriber circulation, and much of that had to be kind of like funded out of pocket. It's sort of a complicated game that all magazines were playing to sort of prop up their ad rates. I'm getting really, really technical and boring here.
Well, I think the crux of it was an arbitrage. So they would give out free subscriptions effectively, so they had more subscriptions, and then they would sell they could sell higher rate of advertising because they had a bigger readership.
Well, oftentimes not even free subscriptions, they would pay for the subscriptions. I mean, it's not unlike buying traffic, which happens all the time across. I mean, we don't buy traffic, but so many places do. I mean, you mentioned BuzzFeed and Vice; they were buying millions of dollars of traffic a month. It's not abnormal.
Yeah.
But we said, look, we want to kind of build a new business model, so we are going to boil our subscriber base down to people who actually want to read it and pay full price for it and value the product we're putting out. And that took us from like a 1.6 million circulation down to 600,000, essentially, like really fast. And that's tough because it kind of like eliminates 50% of your print ad revenue. But we were comfortable with that. We said, if we're going to succeed long term, we have to build a real digital business. We have to build a real events business. We have to build a true kind of multimedia operation. So we took that risk. It was not unpainful, but it forced us to really turn a corner and start building things the right way from scratch, and a model that can work for the future and not like hanging on to one that is slowly bleeding out. But the magazine, having gone from, this is a guess, but like 80% of our revenues down to something like maybe 10 to 15%. It is still kind of the heart and soul of what we do. It's still a compilation of our best work, our best journalism, our best photographs in a given month. It still has the cover, which means so much to so many people, means so much to the artists. It's still our main point of creating access, where we're spending, you know, a week, the reporter, you know, trailing the biggest star, most interesting personality in the world, and a day to take an incredible photo and film an incredible video. So again, it's got like outsized presence and impact for kind of what it is to the business. And for that reason, it's a vital part of who we are and what we do. And it's still a huge part of our identity. Like, we have come so far. We publish almost 50 stories a day online, and I don't even know how many posts across all of our social channels, and we live stream, we do all this stuff. But like, still, when you think of Rolling Stone, you do think of the magazine. So it's got to be great. So yeah, it's important to us.
I remember the first time we met, we'd just signed the deal to bring Rolling Stone to Australia, and then we sat in your office and was like, oh, go meet Gus, you know, he's such a nice guy, it's great to hear from him. It's like, yeah, let's go meet him. We sat down, and they were right, you were a nice guy, and it was great. But then you were like the meeting just turned as soon as the cover came up, and you were like, don't fuck up the cover. And we're like, yeah, nah, we're not gonna fuck it up, sorry. You're like, no, don't fuck up the cover. And I was like, oh fuck, we won't fuck up the cover. It just, like, that moment alone, it just really emphasize the whole responsibility of that privilege. And yes, it's a small part of the revenue, but it's the large part of the identity of the company and all the artists that are a part of Rolling Stone.
Yeah. And for any listeners who's not sure maybe what that means, it's like, you have to choose someone worthy, that cover person. It has to be the right time for them to be anointed. And that was one thing that one of your editors at the time said to us very off the cuff in a meeting, was, we don't break artists with the cover, we anoint them. And that has stuck with us, and that has been our North Star, and that's how we choose our cover stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of factors. The sentiment remains the same. Don't fuck that up. It's the most valuable kind of iconic asset we have, and it remains that way because of picking a great subject, and doesn't have to be the most obvious subject. It doesn't have to be, oh, just because they're the most famous person in the world. I mean, earlier this year we had Boy Genius on the cover, but it was capturing it at the very right moment where there's a mystique and an intrigue and they're actually like tapping into culture in a really compelling way. There should be kind of a point of view around it. I mean, again, this cover, we have Peso Pluma, who, when we made that decision, it was tied to the future of music. So the point of that issue is new music. But since that time, I mean, he's become enormous. And it's getting him the inside story on him right at the right moment where there's like all this intrigue and mystery and question. And he is about to become, if not already, you know, at the sort of pinnacle. But then, yeah, keeping it also really high level before that, you know, Dua Lipa. And, but then picking really interesting cultural and news-driven covers or political covers or entertainment covers, not all music. So understanding that feel and that mix is critical. Having a great photographer who can take an iconic photo, critical. And really good design. Critical. Not, you know, taking risks without sort of undercutting the principles of our design identity. I think if you look around at, you know, the New Yorker, for example, it's like they have such a strong design identity. You want to have, you want to kind of know where you are, even if you took the logo off of it. And then pairing it, I think most importantly, with a really, really deep story, like deep reporting, incredible profile or story. Those are the tenets that make a Rolling Stone cover, in my opinion, and should, as you said, not be fucked up.
And so I always think about your position, Gus, because if you take over a business that's struggling or that's kind of, it's only got upside, it's kind of like an adventure as an executive. It's like, what can we make this? Let's go. You took over the most iconic music brand in human history, media brand, that your dad started, and you must have had the don't fuck it up anxiety through the roof. Like, I can't imagine the stress that would have had on you. Did you feel that, or were you just like, now I get to do what I want?
You mentioned the word upside. That word to me now sounds like a luxury. We were staring down the barrel of disaster for years, and when I came into it, at first it was this challenge of like, how do we build up digital? But then very quickly became, how do we pay down an enormous amount of debt with every single dollar of profit made, meaning we could not invest at all into digital and new activities. So I was having to kind of grow that with shifting around resources and being like super scrappy, and ultimately make a plan and put us on a path to give us a real chance at building something built for the future, while sort of protecting the past and preventing this whole sort of family business from succumbing to the pressures of the debt in an environment where print was just falling off of a cliff, and that was at the time, that was our business. So it was an unbelievable amount of pressure, an unbelievably high level of difficulty in terms of sort of just business and operating.
So keeping... you took over, I just want to get the timeline right. So Rolling Stone was bought by PMC in 2017, 2018, right?
2018, yeah.
2018. You were heading up Rolling Stone before that acquisition or post that acquisition?
Well, I initially was, you know, kind of made my way up through the digital department, and then I took over RollingStone.com, and then then I started running digital for the company, so Rolling Stone, Us Weekly, and Men's Journal. And then there just came a point where my dad had a heart attack and he was in the hospital and kind of out of the mix, and it was really clear that we weren't going to be able to kind of survive on our own given what I just said. And I was sort of led the charge of figuring out what to do, and I was young and had really smart, experienced people around me, so it's not like I was doing it alone, but really I had to sell us and Men's Journal for enough that we could satisfy our financial obligations and find a home that secured Rolling Stone's future. And at the time, that was my only focus, right? And the stakes were enormous emotionally for this legacy, but also financially for my family. It was family business, and we were on the hook, and there was a lot of liability. So there was a lot at play, and then finally when I did sell it to PMC, it was a great home. I mean, we ran an extensive process, but found a perfect home for it, and, you know, they wanted me to continue on, and that was exciting to me because I love it, you know, and I believe so much in the mission of it. And then that was the beginning of starting to think about, dream of all the upside and be out of the sort of rough waters and into the kind of blue sky territory and have the backing to start making the investments we needed to build it the right way, build it in a really multimedia way, and, you know, have just kind of ran from it from there. And then in about 21 or 22, that's when I became CEO and took on more, and yeah, now it's been an amazing kind of rise for Rolling Stone. And
the spreadsheet doesn't lie.
Yes,
it's incredible.
It's all paying off.
Yes.
Yeah, you're almost kind of in another mini rebuilding stage at the moment because your editor in chief has left the business. Mm-hmm. So what now for your editorial vision?
Well, in some ways it's very much, you know, true to our roots of great journalism, deep access reporting, telling super interesting stories of national and sometimes international import, and doing it at the highest standards and at the highest level, and being provocative in really interesting ways, and being genuinely curious about culture and society and how all these things kind of intermingle and what music kind of has to say about all of it and how music is playing a role as a vehicle to push the boundaries. So yeah, I mean, I think it's an opportunity to bring on a couple really talented people to add to an already extremely talented team, which is what we have. And we've done so much kind of rebuilding of the team the last couple of years, and it's in an outstanding place. Great mix of people who've been there for a long time and have tons of institutional knowledge and expertise, with just like fresh blood and ideas and young people in every department. And it's honestly, I'm more excited about this staff than I have been about any staff since I've been around in terms of the team. And we'll just kind of continue adding to that, and that's an exciting prospect.
It's so exciting. I know what it's like to be able to add people to your team, and, you know, obviously you only want high performers, and obviously you kind of want to poach rather than go through the application. So I'm pretty excited for you. But you said you're thinking of bringing a couple of people on.
Mm-hmm.
So are you thinking that editor-in-chief role is going to change and you'll have more bodies in the building?
No, we made a couple changes recently. So we, you know, there's just a couple of roles to fill and
got it.
Potential positions to add, and we're always on the hunt for the most talented writers and editors and videographers and whatnot. So, yeah, I think it's a really exciting moment for us.
I feel like it would be remiss of us to talk about the future of journalism and your vision in media without touching on a topic that people are pretty over.
I'm AI. Not over it.
You're not over it? There's some people that are exhausted by it, but I think this is an interesting group to discuss it. Let's talk about AI and music journalism.
Okay.
What are your thoughts?
How's Rolling Stone thinking about it?
Yeah.
My thought is that Luke is a robot
Yeah. Common feedback.
Yeah. dressed in hip clothing.
Is this what humans wear?
Yeah. Luke has a... What is your necklace?
So, Simone Yatch is the most talented science creator on the internet, and she has invented a coat hanger that folds so that if you want to hang your clothes and be close to the wall and take up less space, you can. She sold nearly $1 million worth of it in 30 days, and she sent me a little necklace representation of it.
So, that's what you got.
That's right. Yeah.
Like I said, he's AI.
Yes, I don't know. Real.
It's a great question that, from our perspective, we have no plans to use AI in place of any of our writers.
Yeah.
Which I think was part of the...
In place of is a really great way of putting it.
Yes, because we have used AI to help tell stories and help with aspects of our journalism, especially like our research department and how we can use numbers to put certain pieces together. Now, I don't know what the future holds. We're very focused on the reporting. That is something that an AI cannot do. I think if you are an outfit that is kind of publishing lowbrow stuff or kind of commodity journalism, it probably will be really problematic if it isn't even already, because an AI could do that so quickly.
Problematic unless you utilize it and 10x your business.
Yeah, but
you don't end up being any different. So if you're a low quality publication or a low quality, like just not a very good journalist, then your output is going to be the same that an AI could output. So why do you have a reason to exist?
Well, if you're an early adopter, it could be a point of difference.
There's always going to be like a way to farm that at some big scale and whatever, but that's not our space. I think ultimately it's actually exciting for us because I think the value of real reporting and long form journalism will only continue to be greater. I think there will be a premium on it. So I believe it will change us a little and we'll have to be really nimble and use technology in interesting ways, but ultimately like double and triple down on our core and our North Star, which is that long form journalism. And I do believe that that will only become more valuable in a world where AI permeates even greater.
Valuable and in some ways a bit more accessible too, because if you are using AI to rewrite press releases, then your journalists have more free time to do the proper investigative reporting. Their capacity has freed up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what our comfort levels with publishing solely AI stories. I mean, they're not there now, so it's not freeing up any of our journalists' time at the moment. They are using AI, as I said, as like a research tool, and you know, we've done a lot of reporting about AI. But yeah, I mean, that there could be a world where that happens. But at this moment, I would just clarify and say, like, we have not published anything produced solely by AI.
Not your thing.
So, Gus, the revenue's obviously, like we said, the spreadsheet doesn't lie. The revenue's grown a lot since you took over, did the deal with PMC. What do you pinpoint as is there a core catalyst which has had outsized return for you, or has it been just, you know, a lot of different things have all added up?
Yeah. Well, you've heard me talk about it. Like, the biggest thing that I have focused on is having a diversified business, because I lived firsthand having one massive revenue stream that can change overnight and you're screwed. So for me, it's like I want to have 7 or 8 revenue streams that are all really healthy, and maybe, you know, I mean, certainly digital advertising is our biggest, but it's really been a combination of events, e-commerce, licensing, podcast, film and television, digital advertising, print advertising, digital subscriptions, print subscriptions. You know, it's a combination of all those things, and the difference has been kind of making them all work together and building each of them up.
And so why do you think you've been so good at it, but Vice hasn't, BuzzFeed hasn't?
Well, I think both Vice and BuzzFeed raised money at unrealistic valuations that put an unbelievable amount of pressure on their ability to operate. I think if they had been privately held companies with a much more realistic expense basis and office building and team size and just focused on their mission and their journalism, like, I think they'd probably be in a really good spot. But they got
more money, more problems, basically.
Well, I think delusional aspirations in some way, maybe a little bit on each of their part, but also the investors' part. And I think media, it's a very X's and O's business, and you have to be really, really disciplined to make it profitable and grow it in profitable ways. And if you're, you know, selling a dollar for 90 cents, like, it's just in order to show that, you know, your revenues are so great that you're worth so much, like, it's just not going to work long term. And I think that was the philosophy. But at the core of Vice and at the core of BuzzFeed were, like, I think, extremely interesting, energetic sort of editorial ideas. Certainly it saw tons of Rolling Stone and Vice.
Especially the early days.
Especially the early days, yeah. I think that was, I mean, it was felt very gonzo and in the tradition of Rolling Stone. So, I mean, even when they were, like, taking our lunch and I was kind of freaking out, and that was part of what, like, drove me to want to, you know, at that time, build this thing. I just said that I saw Shane Smith recently and said to him that I had met with him before I started doing it, and I left his office and I was like, that motherfucker. I'm coming.
Oh, that's great.
I said I never said that to him, and he said, no, I knew. He said, this guy's gonna be a problem. But no, I mean, it was like both, like, pissed me off and was kind of inspiring to be like, we gotta go, you know, build this thing in that area. But and then BuzzFeed too. Like, BuzzFeed was a really interesting commentary about, like, what the internet was about, and then they put together a great editorial operation run by Ben Smith, who's really talented and still thriving with Semaphore today, and was at the New York Times before that. But I just think there were some unrealistic expectations and kind of eye off the ball of building like a really strong media business, and instead trying to be a technology company or be a television network. And it's just like, good luck.
You don't think that Rolling Stone could do either of those things?
Well, we're not those things. Mm. I mean, I think we can. We're making films. We're, you know, we just got nominated for Grammy for Best Documentary. I think in, you know, we have, I think, like 20 film or television projects in various stages of production or development right now, all core to who we are, all, like, ambitious pieces of journalism, all tied into other aspects of our operations reporting. And we've tried really interesting things with using different technologies and whatnot, but no, we are not a technology company. We are not a television network. We are a journalism company. And that can be applied in all these interesting ways, and that is very much what we're doing, but that's not the foundation of who we are or what we're trying to be. Those are, like,
extensions of journalism.
Those are extensions of what the core is, yeah.
So you've obviously worked out a model of growing a brand and a business like Rolling Stone. And then you look over at Vice, who've done, especially in the early days, I'll say they were a very different company towards the end, but the early days, they were amazing. BuzzFeed, same sort of deal. And they're bargain prices now. Like, why aren't you tempted to just go and buy them and build them like you did with Rolling Stone? You've got the skill set, you've got the expertise, you've got the team, you've got the formula.
Well, I mean, we have done a lot of that with NPMC and been very successful at it. Mm. It has to be the right deal and the right brand. You know, we've taken a look at all sorts of things. And Vice is a really complicated deal. So it's just got to, I mean, you know, Sports Illustrated was floating around. I mean, there's all sorts of, but again, like PMC has done an excellent job of that, of taking brands that are great, that need the right focus and business model. You know, I personally am interested in figuring out how we can play with other mediums. Like, as you know, we acquired Life is Beautiful, the music festival, you know, potentially looking at things in the film and production space to continue extending and build Rolling Stone, which is such a global brand. So that's kind of, but yeah, if a good deal is there, you always
you look at everything.
Yeah. It makes sense. Like, you think about longevity and culture, and, you know, Rolling Stone takes the cake for sure. So you may as well double down on that brand and extend its longevity.
What stresses you most about your job?
Oh my God. Depends on the day so much. Just honestly, like, I get stressed with myself. I'm like, am I being creative enough? It's so tempting to get down the rabbit hole of managing people and addressing kind of fires that need to be put out. And, you know, at any given day in any department, there's going to be a problem or an issue that needs to be solved or managed or whatever. So it's like, you can just get so lost in that. So that stuff stresses me out, is kind of like part one. But the bigger answer to the question is, if I'm not like giving myself enough space to actually be creative and come up with good ideas, because you cannot, in my opinion, build a business off of business. I mean, you can, but not it. I feel like a great business needs to be built off a great idea. And you look at Apple, like Steve Jobs, he was a product person. I'm not trying to, but just to be clear.
No, I understand.
I'm just saying, yeah. Like, if you look at great leaders of great companies, my dad included, like, he was an editorial person. So
does this mean you get really stressed out when you see a story published that you don't like because you're so product focused?
Of course.
Because it's hard. Like, you can't read every story before it's published.
No, and that's not my job.
So how are you, like, what systems or policies, or how do you sort of build out that structure so that when you see something published you don't like, it's rare?
You hire the right people. And you set the right editorial direction and kind of mission. And you come up with big ideas that can sort of chart the map for what beats we're going to cover most closely. And you hire great writers to execute on that. And you create a really collaborative environment where, like, people feel really free to spitball ideas and kind of throw things against the wall, you know, even if they're bad, but then kind of like develop into something genuinely good and interesting and innovative. But for me, it's like a combination of those things. But more than anything, great talent.
You play golf, you surf. I've seen you play golf with DJ Khaled. I'm a big DJ Khaled fan. Are you better than him?
Well, I just started playing golf.
Yeah.
He plays every day. I will be clear. When we played, I had just started, and he won on the 18th hole. We were like in the...
You just started.
I was up three on him for a while. I actually had never played a full 18 holes at that point. I'd only ever played 9 holes. After like 12 holes, like, I was like up three. And then he kind of came back, and he's squirrely. Like, I'll give it to him. He's squirrely, and he's probably better than you might think he is, but not as good as he thinks he is. But an amazing, I mean, he has the power of self-belief unlike anyone I've ever seen. And that's part of what I love about him. But so since then, though, I've had the opportunity to play several more rounds. And I think I know I'm significantly better than I was then. So I don't know how much better he's gotten. But if he's around the level he was and he had been playing every day for years up to that point, then I think I'm better than him now and will beat him when we do our rematch. And that we've been trying to organize that rematch. But
does he know that you think that?
Yeah. What? I mean, yes, I've said that to him. But
all right. And so how are you as a competitive person? Because I feel like the way you are in sport is the way you are in business. So what are you like on the golf course, you know, is your competitive spirit at level 100 or are you just happy to have a social game?
If you ask that question to my friends or family, they might fall off their chair. I think they would all say I'm the most competitive person that they know. But that's what they would say. I don't know that I would agree with that. But yeah, I'm pretty competitive.
Are you letting the person say the ball rolls into a divot? Are you letting them take the ball out of the divot?
Look, I don't know the intricacies of I don't know the rule book of golf intimately enough. Like, just as long as it's consistent. I mean, I do feel like you have to have integrity in sport.
Yeah.
Because it's really tempting not to. But yes, if it comes to like, can I win? Like, I would, short of, you know, breaking the rules, like, I will do anything to win. Honestly.
Amazing. So the next time you and Khaled play, I hope it's documented on his Insta. It's the best Instagram account on the internet, I reckon.
He's hysterical.
He's amazing.
He's a genius.
What is the one thing you're looking forward to about Rolling Stone over the next 5 years? What's the thing you're really hoping?
I want us to win the Oscar for Best Documentary.
I knew it was going to be film related.
Well, look, there's so much to do. But like realistically, we should be making 3 or 4 incredible documentaries out of our reporting a year. It's a really important way to do exactly what we do in a kind of new format at the highest level and build a stable or work with incredible directors. And it's just such a natural extension for us and, you know, builds on places that we already are, like reporting we're already doing, access we already have. So I want us to not only build a real business around that, like a real one, but I want us to be recognized for it at the highest levels.
Are you towing both lines at the same time? Meaning, do you have a writer who's working on a really interesting story that would make a great documentary one day? And so because of the access that that journalist has got, are you filming it? Are you making sure that not only are they reporting on it for an editorial piece, but in that moment, they're getting assets ready for the...
Yeah, we're doing a lot of that.
Great.
We have like multiple stories right now where they're being reported in real time, both for, you know, a feature and for, you know, we have film crew down with them, or, you know, they're working kind of like hand in glove and we're developing that at the same time. Yeah.
Great. Best way to do it.
Gus, I've said this to you before, but I genuinely feel as Rolling Stone custodians in Australia, we feel so lucky to have you as the leadership of the global company. You should be so proud of everything you've done, and I'm fucking pumped for the next 5 years. Thanks so much for coming on, Gus.
I appreciate that. Thank you for having me.